Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, August 5th, 2026, on 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza has been caught in a primary. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND for 30 days, and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. So, health-wise, I'm doing okay. Still deciding how much my back and leg warrant getting another opinion about going to the neurosurgeon. Meanwhile, it's not too bad right now. I'm able to ride my bike some. I'm able to do yoga. I'm able to do my physical therapy exercises. And I'm able to manage the discomfort pretty well with things like my vagus nerve stimulator and ice and stretching and all kinds of stuff like that. So we're getting through that. My Lyme symptoms are pretty good. The only thing is sometimes I get really tired, and the really tired is improved by, wait for it, naps. Getting more sleep helps me to feel less tired. Shocking, right? So I do recommend taking the nap if you are in a point in the day where you just can't even and you have the time to do it. Getting a power nap is a great thing. If you nap for maybe 20 minutes or something or half an hour, it can really change your day. It can really change how you feel. So it's a really good thing. So I do recommend it. And so in terms of Lyme, I was given a second round of amoxicillin. I don't know if my PCP intended to give it to me, but when you talk about ILADS, the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, they will recommend up to 2 months, for an acute case of Lyme disease, up to 2 months of an antibiotic. So I'm doing amoxicillin for 2 months. I have a week left of it, and I'm going to just finish it out. I'm taking a great probiotic with it, Saccharomyces boulardii, so I have minimal digestive issues. Everything's doing what it's supposed to do. Saccharomyces boulardii, among other things, keeps stuff together. Saccharomyces boulardii can be used on its own to help to treat diarrhea. I'm also wondering if there's any chance I get exposed to that cyclosporiasis parasite. Saccharomyces boulardii will keep it out of bit. As I'm doing the Saccharomyces boulardii, and then midday I take a multiprobiotic of bacteria because, the amoxicillin is happening at either end of the day. So I'm hoping that some of the good bacteria get in if I take it midday. And meanwhile, I eat yogurt too, and I'm eating a lot of fiber, fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, clean protein, salads, all kinds of stuff like that. And yes, I'm eating salad because we get our greens from the farmer's market. We get our greens from the local growers. We're not getting it from the grocery store. Did go to a fast casual restaurant who was serving romaine, and I asked him, am I going to get the parasite from that? And he said, our romaine, it's romaine, first of all, and second of all, it's locally sourced. So you should be fine. So far, I am fine. Thank goodness. I do have a friend who tested positive for cyclosporiasis, and she's awaiting medical care. She's not sure what medication she's going to take yet. The first medication they give you is the sulfa drug, Bactrim, which is trimethoprim and sulfamethoxazole. Anyway, so those drugs, if you are sulfa sensitive, you can't take them. And there's numerous people are allergic to sulfa drugs. And then there's concern that there's side effects from the sulfa drugs. So if you don't take a sulfa drug, you might be given a fluoroquinolone like ciprofloxacin or levofloxacin or moxifloxacin, one of the floxacins. So, and they have issues on their own that they can cause tendon rupture. So that's a concern. Hopefully, if you don't take it for a long time, that won't happen. But I'm looking forward to finding out what happened with my friend who tested positive for the cyclosporiasis. They're still not entirely sure where the cyclosporiasis came from, because I think that the company that supposedly distributed the lettuce that had it was let off the hook. They found that it was a false positive. So they're not entirely sure where it's coming from. I don't know if our natural antiparasitics will help against cyclosporiasis. I don't know if anybody knows for sure because it hasn't been stated, it hasn't been tested, but it probably can't hurt to try them. And if you regularly have oregano oil around, you might want to have a couple of drops in your water at this time. I would say, again, I can't guarantee that this is going to protect you or prevent cyclosporiasis, but the things that we have that are antiparasitics in our toolbox are oregano oil, Artemisia annua especially, and so that's another one, and berberines can be great against all kinds of microorganisms, and even some of the Lyme herbs like Cryptolepis, which I'm still taking for my Lyme disease. Cryptolepis can go after parasites too. It's something we use Cryptolepis to go after Babesia, which is an intracellular parasite. So some of the Lyme herbs might be helpful for this, but Artemisia annua, Sweet Annie, is one we use for Lyme disease. It's definitely considered to be an antiparasitic. And then there's the black walnut, wormwood combinations that you see, and those might be helpful as well. Can't say 100%. I am so far so good, and I have not cut back on eating produce, of course. And I have gotten berries from the grocery store and without a problem. I'm not sure if I'm going to continue to do that. I'm definitely eating blueberries from a local farm, and the local farm is wrapping up their season. So I may go back to that local farm and pick some more blueberries before they close for the year. And so that would be my preference. I mean, getting fresh and local, you cannot lose, because you're very unlikely to catch an illness from fresh and local. And you're supporting local businesses, and you know the farmers. You can go to the farmers, either the farm itself, or you can go to the farmer's market where the farmers are selling their goods, and talk to them about their farming practices and learn about how incredibly intensely they tend to their produce. I mean, if you talk to Brian O'Hara from Tobacco Road, he will tell you all about how he uses compost, how they do crop rotation, they put fish emulsion and minerals in the soil, and he's just some of the most nutritious produce comes from right here in northeastern Connecticut. It's really incredible, because Brian's produce is par excellence, and he has mentored a lot of the local we can't say organic because they're not certified organic, but they are unsprayed and they don't use any kind of chemicals whatsoever. So I like to think of them as hyper organic. They are they're not certified organic, but they use meticulous, incredible natural farming practices, and your produce is going to be really terrific and fresh and very nutritious if you go for the local farmers in the area. And you're very unlikely to catch a parasite if you do that. So, all right, so that's what's going on with cyclosporiasis. There's still concern about it. Some people are testing positive for it. There's some accusation that the reduction in staffing to the FDA and food safety organizations in the United States have contributed to this, because there's not as much oversight over our food supply. So that's going on too. Interesting stuff. All right. So here's the things of the week. So the first thing we're going to talk about is how much coffee you should drink. And for me, it's probably none, but I do drink a little bit. And I am probably a slow metabolizer of caffeine. I'm assuming I am, because a little goes a long way. I have had a little bit today. What I did is I went to Silk City, which is the cafe in Willimantic, and I got a cold brew, and I sipped off a little bit of it, and then I brought the rest of it home, and that's how I take my coffee. I take little sips, and that cold brew, now that cold brew is so good, it's the profile of the flavors is so good, I don't put anything at all in it. I sip it like it's a beer or a glass of wine, and I'm keeping it in the fridge, and I'm sipping off it a few sips a day. That's all I get, because it's really strong. And I am a slow metabolizer of caffeine. I have not done the genetics to find that out for sure, but I will probably do it at some point. And I was interested, because I was watching a video, the gentleman who is the CEO of Mudwater. So Mudwater is a product you can buy if you want to. And it's got that their signature product, the first product that they put together, was an organic powdered black tea, which they mixed in chai spices, some turmeric and cinnamon and I think ginger, a few, you know, a bunch of chai spices, and then a whole bunch of their local organically grown mushrooms, all kinds of medicinal mushrooms, and that's what Mudwater is. And so that's their signature product. They have since come out with a Mudwater coffee. They've come out with a Mudwater matcha, and they've come out with a Mudwater turmeric drink beverage that's caffeine free. So they have all of those now. And so the gentleman who is the CEO, he said in a video, first of all, we don't expect this to fix everything for you. We expect that this is something has medicinal mushrooms in it. It's a good product. If you want to try it, you can try it. And the interesting thing that he said, he did 23andMe, and he found out on 23andMe that he was a slow caffeine metabolizer, which is really cool that he bothered to do that. So what he looked at, what I'm telling you, likely he found out, is that a CYP1A2, that's the name of the enzyme, that's the code for the enzyme. It's not the SNP. The SNP has an RS number, but the code, it's a cyclochrome P450 enzyme coded 1A2, and that is the enzyme that breaks down caffeine. So you can be a fast metabolizer, medium metabolizer, slow metabolizer. And he found out that he was a slow metabolizer. I am guessing I'm a slow metabolizer because this much coffee, teeny tiny bit of coffee, and I'm blah, 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 blah. Whereas Ron can drink 3 cups of coffee a day and go to sleep. That would not be me. So he said that he's a slow metabolizer. And so he figured that, he wanted to have a caffeinated beverage, but one that didn't have too much in it. So if you drink a Mudwater that has a tablespoon of the powder in it, you're only getting 35 milligrams of caffeine, which is a reasonable amount. If you have it early in the morning, you're going to break it down over the course of the day. Some people are so sensitive, they can't even do that. And when I make myself a Mudwater latte, I drink it over 2 or 3 days. So I'm getting 10 or 11 milligrams of caffeine from the Mudwater in a day. I do the same thing with a matcha latte. I will make matcha lattes, and I will sip off. I will sometimes make, cold brew coffee lattes. And I sip them over several days. And I will also drink black tea. I'll make an iced tea that I'll keep in the refrigerator with good organic tea. And very, very little bits, and try not to have any past 2 or 3 p.m. in the afternoon so that I can sleep. And I'm probably better off with a lot less than that. But I find that if I make sure that I get good rest, that I can do a little bit earlier in the day. So how much should you have? How much should anyone have? There's good news for coffee drinkers. The American Heart Association issued a comprehensive scientific statement that concluded that drinking up to, 5 cups of coffee a day is safe for most adults, not this adult, and may be associated with a lower risk of several common cardiovascular conditions. Their statement, which was titled Caffeine and Cardiovascular Disease, was published in the American Heart Association's flagship peer-reviewed journal, Circulation, which offered a broad review of current evidence on caffeine, coffee, and cardiovascular health. The statement concluded that consuming up to 400 milligrams of caffeine a day, which is equivalent to roughly 3 to 5 8-ounce cups of regular caffeinated coffee without additives, is generally safe for most adults. 400 milligrams. And that's what they recommend. They say women who are pregnant can have up to 400 milligrams. If I had 400 milligrams of caffeine, I'd be flying. I'd have headaches. I'd have stomach up. I can't do that. Moderate caffeinated coffee consumption appeared to link to a lower risk of coronary heart disease, heart failure, and stroke, while the evidence on irregular heart rhythm is more mixed. The statement includes notable caution about brewing methods, coffee that's prepared without paper filtration, including espresso, French press, Turkish coffee, and boiled coffee, retains the compound cafestol, which supposedly can raise LDL cholesterol. Paper-filtered drip coffee and instant coffee do not carry the same cafestol-related concern, the statement says. And I have read other studies on that saying that, you know, if you don't use a filter, if you use French press coffee, or, espresso, whatever, where you don't use the paper, that it raises your cholesterol. The amount that it raises your cholesterol is minimal. I would say that because the thing is, when you're sending coffee through paper, you take a lot of, there's a lot of principles that come out of it. The cafestol comes out, and that's not the only thing that comes out. And you will taste the paper. And if you're going to filter it with a filter, almost nobody does that anymore. That's the thing. I mean, a lot of people use Keurigs. You know, they use the pods, which I'm not a fan of the pods, especially if you're using the plastic pods. If you're using a stainless steel pod, then have at it. And that's a thing to do, that if you have one of those pod-based coffee makers, it's a good idea to toss the plastic pods, or if you have the plastic pods, you can get stainless steel pods useful in your coffee filter online, and then dump whatever, if you have selections of pods, open the pod, recycle the pod, get rid of it, and put the contents of the pod into a stainless steel carrier, and then use that. And it makes it easy for you. You can use your pod-based coffee filter or coffee maker or tea maker, and you're not sending hot water through plastic and getting microplastics into your beverage. So this thing is, you know, there's so many wonderful principles in coffee, tea, matcha, that can be altered by using a paper filter. And if you're going to use a paper filter, please use one that's unbleached. You don't want to get bleach in the chemicals they use to bleach out paper into your coffee. But I don't think the cafestol doesn't raise your cholesterol nearly as much as overdoing starch and sugar, stress, not getting enough exercise, and eating poor quality fats. Those are much more concerning in the context of a healthy diet. So if you're eating fruits and vegetables, nuts and seeds, clean protein, legumes if you tolerate them, and healthy protein, and you are having French press coffee, I think you're okay. And you're getting your exercise and you're reducing your stress and all that sort of stuff. I'm not a fan of the filters. I'm not a fan of the filters based on the flavor of the coffee. So, energy drinks. The findings are considerably more skeptical. High caffeine products, energy drinks are concentrated energy shots were associated with cardiovascular harm, including elevated blood pressure and irregular heart rhythm. The AHA noted that energy shots may contain 3 to 4 times more caffeine per fluid ounce than regular brewed coffee, and very high caffeine doses have been linked to abnormal heart rhythms, even in healthy adults under 30. The warning comes about 3 weeks after the FDA announced that the issue of labeling caffeine is a priority item for its 2026 agenda. So you're going to, if you get a product that has caffeine in it, it's going to tell you how much caffeine it is in it once they pass that, that's useful. So in terms of blood pressure, where there's conflicting data that makes clinical guidance difficult, the statement offers a more nuanced finding. Drinking 1 to 3 cups per day was associated with a slightly increased risk of developing high blood pressure in people who currently have optimal readings, while drinking more than 3 cups per day was associated with a lower risk. More than 3 cups a day, you have a lower risk of high blood pressure. That's very interesting. Whereas if you have less than that, your blood pressure can go up. What's up with that? The statement recommends that people with high blood pressure consult their healthcare provider. Anyway, I know for me, what I tend to do, because, you know, I do have low grade high blood pressure, is if it's a day where I'm going to see a medical practitioner is going to take my blood pressure, I don't have any caffeine. Or at least I wait to have caffeine until after I've had that appointment. And I try to skip the caffeine and sugar a few days before as well. And then my blood pressure tends to sit a little bit lower. I'm not doing too badly because I'm taking a lot of things that help to moderate blood pressure, including 5 milligrams of lisinopril. But I don't take any more than 5 milligrams of lisinopril because above that, I get dizzy. But I'm taking Amla, and I'm taking vitamin C and fish oil and magnesium and hawthorn and motherwort. So I'm taking a lot of things that help to regulate blood pressure, and coenzyme Q10. So additions matter. So there's the familiar caveat that when you add stuff to black coffee or espresso, when you add sugar, flavored syrups, milk, or cream, it can reduce coffee's potential health benefits and lead to negative health outcomes. So if you're looking for the compounds in coffee that help to, because coffee, black coffee helps to regulate your blood sugar. It actually is a choleretic and a cholagogue. It actually helps to improve your liver function, but it will only do that really if it's black. If you start adding stuff to it, sugar does not help your liver function. It slows it down. If you put dairy in coffee or tea, it will reduce the amount of the flavanols and the active compounds in coffee and tea that are beneficial for you. Same with cocoa. If you're doing raw organic non-alkalized cocoa and you're wanting the cocoa flavanols, if you add dairy to it, it will bind up some of those flavanols, and you're not going to get as much benefit if you have your coffee that with lightened somehow. You're going to get the most benefit if it's black. Of course, somebody like me, where I'm very sensitive to caffeine, I find that if there's fat in my coffee, especially from, so I'm mostly not going to use dairy as a creamer because that I will just get so much gas from that. So I'm using a dairy substitute. I might be using a healthy non-dairy creamer. So not the major conventional brands, but one that you get from the health food store, or, you know, one that has minimal ingredients, or I might be using, a dairy substitute that has minimal ingredients as well. And when I put those things in my coffee, it slows the absorption of the caffeine, and that's helpful for me. I have to be very careful. Like, I have plain cold brew, just a few sips, and I will be flying through the roof. It really affects me a lot. So when you put additives in your coffee, so that's why black coffee is going to be the best for you. And if you want to taste it a little bit sweet, one thing you can do is put seasoning in it. Now, if you like your coffee, you like the flavor of your coffee plain, if you're a black coffee connoisseur and you just want to taste the black coffee, more power to you. But what I try to tell people to do is put cinnamon in your coffee. Get a really good organic cinnamon, and you put the cinnamon in to taste. It makes the coffee taste sweeter, and it makes it taste like cinnamon, which is wonderful. Cinnamon and coffee together are amazing. Other spices you can put in, you can make it Turkish style, where you also add ginger, possibly turmeric, and cardamom. And you can have, I will make lattes where I'll put in cinnamon, ginger, and cardamom, and a non-dairy milk or creamer. And it's wonderful. It's really, really good. And if you can avoid putting a sweetener in, that would be great too. If you want to have something sweet but non-caloric, you can consider stevia or monk fruit, which are low grade in terms of detriments. And the other, if you're going to put a sugar substance in, you could consider honey, you could consider maple syrup, you can consider coconut sugar. I like the idea of coconut sugar. Coconut sugar is not super sweet, but it also, coconut sugar has inulin in it, and inulin is a prebiotic fiber. And so it gives coconut sugar a lower glycemic profile. And if you like the coconut sugar in your coffee, that could be a good way to go. But black is where it's at. Now, interestingly, I had a patient come in not too long ago who was newly on a GLP-1 and she drinks coffee. So I said to her, I asked her if she's drinking organic coffee. She said, no. I said, please drink organic coffee. Your liver is already going to be taxed by the GLP-1. So you don't want to have pesticides, because coffee is heavily sprayed, and you don't want to have pesticides, and, you know, just one more thing to add to the burden on your liver. So drink your coffee black. The other concern is when you take a GLP-1, you tend to lose weight fast. And if you lose weight fast, what's one of the risks of fast weight loss? Gallstones. And people on GLP-1s get gallstones. So I warned her about that. I said, if you drink black coffee, you're less likely to get gallstones. That's true, because what the deal is that black coffee is a cholagogue and a choleretic. That means it moves bile and it causes you to make more bile. So it makes the fluid go through your liver and your whole biliary system more smoothly and readily, and so you have a more effectively functioning liver, which means that black coffee also regulates blood sugar. So it's a really good way to go. If you can handle the caffeine Organic black coffee is really good for you. And then if you want to throw in some functional spices like ginger, turmeric, cardamom, cinnamon, and if you want to throw in mushroom powder, you can do that too and make your coffee more functional. Or you can throw in collagen if you want to. Some people don't want to taste anything but coffee. That's fine too. So you can mix and match. But if you can develop a taste for unsweetened coffee, if you get a really good flavored coffee, it can be one of those connoisseur experiences. Coffee that's really good and well brewed and with care is complex. And it has a lot of complex flavors in it. That's why I talk about the cold brew over at Silk City as a sipping cold brew. You don't put anything in it and you just sip on it and you enjoy the flavor. It's like drinking a glass of wine. It's like drinking, drinking wine or drinking a craft beer, and savoring it slowly. And then you can get a cacao that's that way as well. And so when you get a product like that, you may not need to add anything to it because it's flavored so well. If you get very pedestrian coffee, like your average brands from the grocery store, and they're not organic, they're not fair trade, they're not grown healthfully, you have to add a bunch of stuff to it to make it taste good. And when you go to some of the big coffee chains, their coffee by itself is not a sipping coffee. It doesn't taste good on its own. And so your tendency is to get it with cream, sugar, flavoring, get all the fancy drinks. So it's a really good idea to find a roast that you like that's organic. And the mark of a good coffee is one that you can drink with nothing in it and enjoy, or minimal stuff added to it. You can add a little cinnamon or cardamom or turmeric or ginger, and that's all you need. So the American Heart Association says you could have up to 400 milligrams of caffeine and be okay. That, of course, depends on the person. If you're a slow metabolizer, you're going to be more likely to get hyped up by excessive caffeine and then have an energy crash. So remember what caffeine does. Caffeine blocks adenosine receptors in your brain. If you're watching me on video, you see that I am pointing to my brain. It blocks adenosine receptors in your brain. And remember that adenosine is a compound that builds up in your body. It's lowest in the morning and it rises over the course of the day. It tracks with melatonin. Melatonin is lowest in the morning. Melatonin is a neurotransmitter, a hormone that's made by your brain in the pineal gland, pointing back to my pineal gland. And it also tracks, it's lowest in the morning and highest in the evening. Both melatonin and adenosine make you sleepy. And so it rises over the course of the day till it peaks at about 9-10 o'clock at night, which is a great time for you to go to sleep because you're at your adenosine and melatonin peak. And it has an inverse relationship with cortisol. Cortisol is supposed, if you're healthy, your cortisol peaks in the morning so that you can wake up, and it gradually goes down, 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 doobie-doo, down, down, till it's the lowest at when? Around 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And that, so your cortisol gives you your energy, your fight or flight, just your energy to do stuff during the day, and it bottoms out 9 or 10 o'clock at night. Great time to go to sleep. Remember the saying in Newfoundland and other places, every hour before midnight counts as two. And there's a scientific basis to that. And the scientific basis is the bottoming out of cortisol and the topping out of adenosine and melatonin. If you wait too much longer after that, your melatonin and adenosine start to drop and your cortisol starts to rise again. So if you go to bed midnight, 1 o'clock, you're going to have a harder time falling asleep because of those factors. So what caffeine does, and caffeine from any source, what it does is it blocks adenosine receptors in your brain. So adenosine makes you sleepy. And when your adenosine receptors are blocked, your body is still making adenosine, but it's just not bonding to the adenosine receptors because those receptors are taken up with caffeine. And so what happens is after a while, the caffeine does finally get metabolized slowly by your CYP1A2, depending on your genetics, how fast that it gets metabolized. Once it's metabolized, then you have all this adenosine. So if it all bonds at once, you may get an energy crash. So Shane's idea, Shane who's the CEO of Mudwater, his idea is let's not put so much caffeine in it, but let's have it so it gives you a little high. So it's, you're not, your adenosine receptors aren't all blocked. And when it comes offline, you're not that tired. You have better energy and focus. And because the mud water has the medicinal mushrooms in it, you're getting more benefit, and it has cacao in it. So you're going to get the cocoa flavanols, and you're going to get the L-theanine that's in the black tea too. So it's moderated. You're going to have L-theanine from tea, which is going to moderate the high that you get from the caffeine. And it's not that much caffeine. And I find when I drink mud water, I don't get a hit like I get when I take small sips of caffeine. Now, mud water, of course, isn't the only product that's out there. There are other brands that have, and I'm not, this should not be construed as I'm telling you to get mud water. This is not an advert for mud water. Okay. So, but there are other ways to drink beverages, whether it's coffee, tea, cacao, with mushrooms in it. There are brands that make a cocoa mushroom blend. There are brands that other brands of mushroom coffee, and you can try whichever ones you like and see which one works for you. The other thing to do is, if you're not, you know, Mudwater makes a coffee blend now, and they use caffeinated and decaf coffee so that the caffeine content of a cup isn't super high. And you may or may not like their roast, whatever roast they're using. But if you have a favorite roast of coffee, you have a favorite coffee, I have to get this roast of coffee. I got to get the Peruvian espresso roast from the co-op, and that's it. Or I have to get the Sumatra, or I have to get Panamanian, whatever your roast is. You're a blonde roast person. I am not a blonde roast person. I like mine a little bolder than that. Get whatever your favorite coffee is. And then what you can do is you can get a mixed mushroom powder. There are excellent brands of organic mushroom powders that are mixed adaptogenic mushrooms, or you can choose one adaptogenic mushroom that you're going after. Like if you really want a big adaptogen, cordyceps is one of my favorites. Chaga is a great one because it has a lot of antioxidants in it. But I take cordyceps tincture every day. And I don't drink mud water every day. I don't always drink caffeine, although I've gotten into a place where I'm having a little bit of caffeine every day. But you don't have to get a particular brand. If you have a favorite coffee or a favorite tea and you want to add mushrooms to it, you can do that. And the other thing is, maybe you don't want to have your coffee or tea taste like mushrooms. I must say that the mud water definitely has an earthy taste to it that doesn't taste like straight up chai. And if you don't like that umami, earthy, savory flavor in your coffee or tea, then one way to go is to take the mushrooms and put it into a shake. So I have a protein shake every day, and the protein shake is, I usually use bone broth protein, and it's either chocolate or vanilla flavor. And I do lion's mane every day. And the lion's, when you do powdered mushrooms, it's more economical, I think, that some supplements are more economical if you do them in powder. So there's two that I'm going to be doing in powder. One is there's a few powders that I use. I use spirulina powder. I have a little bit of spirulina in my shake every day. And spirulina is a wonderful antioxidant, multinutrient blue-green algae. So I have a bit of spirulina in my shake every day. Not much, maybe a quarter teaspoon, not a lot, enough to make my shake very green, whatever else is in it. And then I have the bone broth protein, and I have a tiny scoop of lion's mane powder, which is very economical to use. That way I can't taste the lion's mane powder. And that would be another way to do it. You put your mushrooms in a shake. If you're putting it in a shake that's mostly a protein shake, that's your favorite flavor, you're not going to taste it. Also, if you are habitually making a smoothie every day, if you put a little scoop of mushrooms, you're not going to taste it. You're going to taste the fruit and whatever else you got in there. So medicinal mushrooms can be very helpful. But in terms of caffeine, you really have to figure out what caffeine makes you feel like, how you feel when you drink it, how fast you metabolize it. Do you have big rises and big crashes? And it may be an issue of dose rather than having to get off it altogether, or you may have to get off it altogether. It depends if you get migraines, if you get headaches, what other symptoms you get. But the American Heart Association does have a point that coffee in particular can be a healthful beverage. Depending on how fast you metabolize the caffeine and what that means in terms of how you feel and your energy and your digest, because, you know, some people get terrible reflux from drinking coffee. Some people get all kinds of digestive issues from drinking coffee. Some people rely on their coffee to help them go to the bathroom every day. Both kinds of go to the bathroom. Coffee, it's a mixed bag, caffeine, and caffeine is consumed by like 90% of people in the world. I saw a stat like that, and consumed in various ways. So in terms of what caffeine is in, it's in coffee, of course. It's in what we call black tea. And of course, black tea has a lot of varieties, just like coffee does. It depends on where it's grown, what level it's grown at. And then if it's black tea, it depends how it's fermented. So you're going to get different flavors based on the degree of fermentation. And the longer you ferment black tea, the higher the caffeine content in it. So whereas coffee, the longer you roast it, the lower the caffeine content. So your bolder roasts have less caffeine in them than your blonde roasts. Did you know that? Well, there you go. So if it tastes really bold, it's going to have less caffeine in it than if it tastes really mellow. Unless you're getting low acid coffee, then it depends on what's going on with the low acid coffee. But blonde roast has more caffeine in it than espresso roast. And then, you know, the degrees of roasting, a medium roast is in between in terms of caffeine content. So the American Heart Association is saying caffeine is good for your cardiovascular health. Now, if you drink coffee and you get palpitations and that doesn't feel good, it's probably not a good idea. And then you may have to adjust your dose. You may have to not do it. And, you know, I have a tendency to getting, I'm not sure, I haven't been diagnosed, because when I get a resting EKG, my resting EKG is always normal. But, and then I had a cortisone shot, well, a steroid shot in my back. And they put a heart monitor on me and they didn't say anything to me about what was going on with my cardiac function. So I guess it's mostly okay. But I do occasionally feel probably PACs and occasional SVTs, supraventricular tachycardia. And it happens once in a while. And I'll go through periods where I haven't and I'll go through periods where I don't. And I take stuff to calm it down. I take magnesium and I take Hawthorn and I take Motherwort and CoQ10. So those tend to keep it at bay. Also, if I'm in a Lyme flare, I'm more likely to get palpitations. And that's something that people who have chronic Lyme or, you know, have Lyme disease report, because Lyme toxins cause cardiotoxicity. The Lyme will go after the heart. So anyway, it all depends on you and what you want to do. If you coffee, no matter what you do, you don't feel good when you do caffeine, you don't have to have it. There are other ways to do that. And in the meantime, it's going to be a matter of dose, how much you can handle and how you want to prepare it and what form you want to take it in. But the AHA says it's beneficial for your cardiovascular health. Remember, blanket statements, generalizations. Generalizations are just that, they're generalizations. And in terms of medicine, naturopathic medicine is very much about individual healthcare. So, you know, each person is going to be different. So you're going to address whatever's going on with them individually. Okay. All right. So that's what's going on with coffee. That's how much you should drink. How much should you drink? The answer is, it depends. All right, let's talk about bergamot and cholesterol. I have patients coming in asking me if bergamot can lower cholesterol. The spoiler is I haven't seen it do it, and I don't know if I'm not giving people enough, but I have people taking the bergamot, and I don't see much movement in their cholesterol numbers. So bergamot, which has polyphenols and flavonoids, may reduce total cholesterol and triglycerides while potentially increasing your HDL cholesterol, your good cholesterol. So bergamot is a citrus fruit that's found primarily in southern Italy's Calabria region. I didn't know that. And has a long history in traditional Italian medicine for treating fever and infections. And some research has backed the fruit's antioxidant and anti-inflammatory benefits, which demonstrates its potentially beneficial cholesterol-lowering properties. So, by the way, bergamot is what makes Earl Grey tea, Earl Grey, and it has this sort of citrusy note to it. I don't care for Earl Grey. Some people just love their Earl Grey, and I'm not a big Earl Grey person. So clinical trials have demonstrated that orally administered bergamot in various forms may reduce total cholesterol and LDL levels. Lab studies suggest that bergamot's polyphenols may influence specific enzymes related to cholesterol metabolism. There was a 12-study review that found that bergamot supplementation resulted in total cholesterol decrease from 12 to 31%, which is not nothing. LDL cholesterol decreased from 7.6 to 40%. 40% is certainly not nothing. Triglycerides decreased from 11 to 40% also. That's impressive. 8 trials also showed that increased HDL levels after bergamot intervention and showed a potential dose-dependent effect and synergy with statins, offering a possible alternative for dyslipidemia management, especially in statin-intolerant individuals. In one study, researchers discovered that although bergamot fruit extract didn't directly block an enzyme involved in making cholesterol, probably HMG-CoA reductase, it reduced the overall cholesterol levels in liver cells and limited cholesterol absorption in intestinal cells. So it helps to prevent you from absorbing cholesterol from your diet, and it also reduce the levels of your cholesterol in the liver cells, and that may be because you're excreting more of it, so there's less circulating. There's one compound found in bergamot extract that's called neohesperidin, which decreased the activity of an enzyme responsible for cholesterol production while boosting the function of another enzyme associated with control. And there was another compound, brutiaridin, which curbed cholesterol absorption in intestinal cells by influencing a key protein that transports cholesterol. How long does it take? The studies show that that reductions in cholesterol levels after several weeks of regular supplementation. In the trials, they do it for 1 to 6 months, but the time it takes for bergamot extract to lower cholesterol can vary among individuals. The best form for managing cholesterol, they're not entirely sure. You can get fruit extracts, supplements, juices. They've all been used in clinical studies and show potential in reducing cholesterol. Determining the exact amount of bergamot to take for cholesterol management can vary based on several factors, including the form, whether it's an extract, an oil, or a supplement, its concentration, and individual health conditions. Typical doses in studies that examine bergamot's cholesterol-lowering effects have ranged from around 150 milligrams to 1,500 milligrams of extract a day. So I may be underdosing my patients. That may be one of the things that's good. So now they come in and they tell me, what about bergamot for cholesterol? And I'm like, nah, because I just haven't seen it work. But it may be because I was supporting underdosing, and I have to look into that. These days, I'm more of a fan of amla, and I talked about amla last week. Amla has so many health benefits, and amla is less expensive too. Like you can get amla in ways that are very economical and take a lot of it and take a clinically significant dose of it and not spend a lot of money. So I think that's important too. And whereas bergamot, if you're going to take high doses of bergamot, it's expensive. Bergamot can cause side effects. It can cause increased sensitivity to sunlight. That doesn't excite me because I want my patients outside, and especially this time of year. Well, not now because it's raining buckets, but I want my patients outside. And so something that makes you sun sensitive doesn't excite me. So it can increase your risk of sunburn or skin irritation. Bergamot may interact with drugs that cause photosensitivity, as well as certain antibiotics and diabetes medications. So if you take bergamot along with doxycycline, this is the time of year when you might be more likely to take doxycycline if you get diagnosed with Lyme or anaplasma or a tick-borne illness. Yeah! Some studies suggest that bergamot extract may enhance statin effects, and combining them can intensify the effects and raise the risk of muscle pain. So that's the thing. If one of the ways that bergamot works is it's an HMG-CoA reductase inhibitor, you're going to have similar possibilities for side effects as statins. And some people get allergic reactions to them, like rashes, itching, burning, or difficulty breathing. So of course you should take it. You should talk to a healthcare practitioner. You don't want to take it if you're pregnant or nursing, just because they don't know how it affects. There's not enough reliable data on it. We don't know how it works for those people. Children, it's not recommended for children. Just because, again, the safety hasn't been established. However, if you're eating the bergamot fruit because you live in Italy, if you live in Calabria and you have access to bergamot fruit, if I were in Calabria, I would eat bergamot fruit. I would get some local bergamot and try it. Absolutely. I hope I get to go to Italy one day. I would really like to. I'm studying Italian on Duolingo. Perfetto. Per favore. Un cornetto e un cappuccino, per favore. That's what I know so far. Io ho una sorella. That means I have a sister. Yeah. And bergamot can increase your skin sensitivity to sunlight. We already talked about that. And if you're taking certain medications, it can interact with and enhance certain medications, especially statins and other cholesterol-lowering meds. So if it helps the body to excrete cholesterol more readily, then if you're taking the way that ezetimibe works, it is not a statin. It's a cholesterol-lowering medication that causes you to excrete more cholesterol through your stool. So if that's part of how bergamot works, then it's going to increase that effect. So it's been indicated that when you take orally administered bergamot, it can be beneficial in reducing total cholesterol, but talk to your healthcare practitioner to sort out all the odds and ends. All right. Very good. So that's bergamot. Now let's look at cocoa extract and cardiovascular disease. Everybody likes to talk about chocolate. So there was a new study where researchers knew as of last year anyway. This was published on, do you remember, the 21st day of September? That's when this was published last year. So it's not that old. It was published less than a year ago. So there's a new study where they examined whether cocoa extract supplements have an impact on age-related inflammation, which is linked to heart disease and other chronic illnesses. And the researchers found that 500 milligrams of daily cocoa extract slowed increases in a key marker of inflammation. And those benefits were strongest in individuals with higher baseline or existing inflammation at the start. When people get older, they're likely to develop chronic health issues like cardiometabolic, neurodegenerative, and bone diseases. According to the CDC, 1 out of 4 people will be age 65 or older by 2060. That's a quarter of the population. With such a large percentage of people at risk for chronic health issues, there's a need for more attention and reducing the likelihood of those issues. So there was a study from Mass General Brigham that looked into how cocoa extract supplements can affect inflammation markers. The study findings showed that taking cocoa extract supplements regularly for 2 years can improve inflammation markers, and the findings appeared in the Journal of Age and Aging. So they tracked 5 biomarkers related to inflammation. And so there are inflammation markers in the body that signal the presence of inflammation. Some diseases that are associated or caused by chronic inflammation are heart disease, stroke, type 2 diabetes, Alzheimer's, and rheumatoid arthritis. So the researchers focused on cocoa extract supplement in relation to inflammation markers because it is high in flavanols, which are plant-based antioxidants. Since the primary flavanol in cocoa extract was previously found to improve cardiovascular health, the researchers in the new study wanted to further examine how cocoa extract supplements affect specific inflammation biomarkers over a longer period of time. They focused on older adults, women age 65 and above, and men age 60 and above. The researchers tracked 3 inflammation markers over 2 years, as well as an anti-inflammatory protein and an immune-mediating protein. The researchers collected blood samples at the beginning of the study at the 1 year point and 2 years to assess for inflammation markers, and they took 500 milligrams of cocoa supplement daily. So after analyzing the blood samples and comparing inflammation levels at the beginning and end, results show that cocoa extract supplements can help reduce age-related inflammation. The people who took the cocoa extract saw their level of high sensitivity C-reactive protein drop by about 8%. Not huge, but it's something. Significant since hsCRP is linked to an increased risk of chronic diseases, especially heart disease and stroke. It also boosted levels of interferon gamma, which is a protein involved in the immune system, by nearly 7% compared with placebo. But the cocoa extract didn't make a clear difference in other inflammation-mediated markers like IL-6, interleukin-6, which can contribute to heart disease, was reduced slightly in women but not men. By the way, curcumin, turmeric, reduces IL-6. So you have other ways to do that. So one of the inflammation markers tested, hsCRP, is the marker most likely to be influenced by lifestyle factors and medications such as statins. Another interesting finding was the benefits of cocoa extract supplements were more pronounced in people with higher baseline inflammation. So when the cocoa supplement study findings show that it can reduce inflammation markers related to aging, the researchers noted that further research is needed since the study participants were predominantly white. So you need to test it on people of color. I'm pretty sure that most people in the world are not white, and we have lots of people of color in our country too. So Raj Dasgupta, who is the chief medical advisor to Sleepopolis and ABIM quadruple board certified physician, especially in internal medicine, pulmonology, gave his thoughts. And he said that the study results are encouraging and explain the importance of the findings. High-sensitivity C-reactive protein is one of the most widely used and well-characterized inflammatory biomarkers for predicting cardiovascular risk. Elevated levels are associated with a higher risk for things like heart attack and stroke. You can ask your primary care physician or your cardiologist or really anybody who orders blood work for you to order high-sensitivity CRP, and it's covered by insurance. All the ordinary labs do it. So, I mean, if you go to the hospital or if you go to a place like Quest or any other lab drawing place, they do hsCRP, high sensitivity C-reactive protein. I order it for my patients pretty routinely as well. So cocoa does contain compounds that act a bit like stimulants. If you're on medications or are sensitive to caffeine, you might want to check with your doctor, because cocoa can, depending on how caffeine sensitive you are, can make you wired. So the cocoa supplements did drop high sensitivity CRP. The findings are just one piece of the puzzle. So you can't just take cocoa and expect everything to be hunky-dory. You still have to get the good diet, get your exercise, your good sleep, stress reduction, don't smoke, and it's a promising add-on. So again, if you're going, you can take cocoa in a pill, or if you're going to add cocoa easily to your life, we get a non-alkalized cocoa powder from the food co-op, and I don't use it every day, and maybe I should, but Ron does. He puts it in his smoothie, and we keep the cocoa powder around all around. It's a really brilliant deep dark cocoa product, and it doesn't have, so it's non-alkalized. And when you alkalize cocoa, it makes it less bitter, but it also takes out a lot of the flavanols. So you want the cocoa flavanols are what give you the antioxidant benefits, blood sugar regulation, metabolic health, all of that stuff. So if you want all those benefits, you have to get non-alkalized cocoa. If you just get an average chocolate bar from the drugstore or from the grocery store, it's not going to be super high in flavanols. So yeah, that's why you have to get at least 70% dark chocolate. And remember, when you eat chocolate that's a chocolate bar, it's going to have sugar in it. When you eat not unsweetened cocoa, you can have as much as you want. It's very low in calories and it will have all the health benefits for you. So finding a way to do it that's unsweetened, you can add it to things that are already sweet, like fruit or your smoothie. And you've heard me talk about adding non-alkalized cocoa nibs. Cocoa nibs can go into a salad. You can have a garden salad that you can add berries or goji berries to it, and also cocoa nibs, and you'll have, and then use balsamic vinegar along with your olive oil, and then you'll have a lovely sweet-based, you know, sweetly seasoned salad. And if you are able to eat cheese, you can throw goat cheese in there or feta cheese, And those are milder cheeses, and all those flavors are really nice. And then you get the cocoa nibs in, it gives it a crunch, and it tastes chocolatey, and you won't mind that it's bitter because you have these sweeter elements all around it. And if you have a fruit salad, you can throw cocoa nibs on the fruit salad as well. Or if you're eating yogurt, if you're eating oatmeal, the cocoa nibs go nicely in the oatmeal and the fruits and the yogurt. So those are great ways to get flavanols and unsweetened cocoa and not have to worry about the sugar. Okay, so what else do I want to talk about today? I only have a couple of minutes, so I don't know if I want to get started on anything new, so I'm just going to give you some general health advice. That make sure you're doing your stress reduction. If you want to do vagal nerve toning, there's simple things that you can do. You can rub the tragus of your ear pinna. You can also rub the tragus of your ear, which is that little in the front of your ear pinna, your ear. The ear pin is this part that sticks out of your ear, and the one that's most to the front, that little knob that sticks out, you can rub that because you have external branches of the vagus nerve, the ventral vagus nerve, that come through there. And if you rub them, that can be a quick way to reduce stress. And also, if you rub that SCM muscle, the sternocleidomastoid muscle, that's that ropey muscle that connects your behind your ear down to your collarbone, and the branches of the vagus nerve run along that. So you can massage that, and that can make you feel more relaxed. You can splash your face with cold water. You can sing. You can hum. You can tone any vowel sound that you like, or any consonant sound that you can sustain. It's easy to sustain M and N. But you can also tone any vowel sound that you can like, that you like. Ah, e, e, I, o, u. And when you tone om, of course, when you're saying om, om is, a unifying principle in the universe from Sanskrit. And you can certainly tone that, but you can tone any sound that feels good to you. You just take a deep breath in and let sound out. Regular singing, whatever kind of song you like to sing, helps to increase the activity of the ventral vagus nerve. And the ventral vagus nerve is the part of the vagus nerve that gives you your rest and digest and calms you down and takes you out of fight or flight. And then remember that sitting still is a good thing. Sitting still and relaxing, breathing, sitting in your yard, looking at the birds, looking at the trees, getting out in nature, just generally doing that. Those things are just as important to do as stuff where you feel like you're accomplishing something. And remember that rest, whether it's good sleep or whether it's taking a time out so that you can calm your cortisol down, can turn into anything. It can turn into energy and focus to do anything that you want to in your life. So that's what I got for you today. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch, ND. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of the station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores and WHUS.org. Thank you for listening.